Great speeches have moved, persuaded, and rallied people for generations. But there are some fundamental elements that go into making a speech great. Simon Lancaster, one of the country's leading speech writers, reveals some of these basic rules, which date back to ancient Greece.
The master of rhetoric was Aristotle, back in around 350 BC, and he wrote this wonderful text called Rhetoric, which to me is still the Bible. Aristotle said that rhetoric was based upon three things. You have ethos, which is the character of the speaker, his credibility, whether or not the audience trust him. Then you have pathos, which is the emotions of the audience. And then you have logos, which is the reasoning of the argument.
Rhetoric, the art of persuading and pleasing people, was a valued part of a traditional education, and many of the key elements of rhetoric still hold good to this day. Tom Clark is the editor of Historic 20th Century Speeches.
Traditionally, rhetoric was an elite activity. What changed it was the advent of democracy, where suddenly the elite had to reach out beyond their own in order to try and change people's minds. The modern age in rhetoric really begins with an address that lasted only 2 minutes in 1863 at Gettysburg.
Abraham Lincoln delivered the famous Gettysburg Address during the American Civil War in 1863. It stands out for its simplicity and contains all the aspirations that a modern democracy strives for.
It marked a turning point in the way that the elite, if you like, or the powerful, the politicians, communicated with the public at large. And it was just a wonderful, simple speech. It was something like 261 words in total, and 205 of those were one syllable. And I love it because of that. But of course, it had that terrific soundbite to die for about government of the people, by the people, for the people, which is technically a work of genius.
However clever the rhetoric or skillful the speaker, Tom Clark believes that a speech is remembered only if it captures the zeitgeist, the spirit of the time.
I think that the speeches that we really remember are those that, for us, define a personality, or those that, in some cases, demolish a personality or rally a cause in a way that it's not quite been rallied before. And so we can look back then and identify the speech as something that changed history.
But on this January night, at this defining moment in history, you have done what the cynics said we couldn't do.
Barack Obama speaking in January 2008 after he won Iowa's Democratic nomination in the race for the American presidential election.
That had a ring of authenticity about it, both because he wasn't white and also because it was, of course, true. Every black activist, every white racist had said that this day would never come, and him contradicting what everyone had agreed on before that, simply by saying it, it came from him, it moved the audience and it defined the moment.
In the UK, the early 1980s was a time of mass unemployment and the government's popularity was at its lowest. Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher rallied her Conservative Party and gave her most famous speech. It's remembered mainly because it encapsulated a historical moment that defines her to this day.
We shall not be diverted from our course. To those waiting with bated breath for that favourite media catchphrase, the U-turn, I have only one thing to say. U-turn if you want to. The ladies, not for turning.
Borrowing this very obscure reference from the theatre about the ladies not for burning, she used this, the ladies not for turning line, which got captured in all the media and was run away at the time. Also calling herself the Iron Lady of the Western World, something that the Russians had been referring to her as, which she then turned to her own advantage. All these images of strength she pulled together in response to the events she was saying and created a caricature which wasn't entirely flattering but was very much to her advantage, and it was one that lives on to this day, really.
Women are underrepresented in the pantheon of great recorded speeches. Tom Clark.
Speeches that we remember tend to be made by leaders, and leaders tend to reflect who's got the power at any one time. I should just add, however, one of the really great rhetoricians of our time, Tony Benn, always says that the best speech he's ever heard given in his life was by someone who'd never given a speech before, which was a wife of one of the miners during the 1984 miners' strike.
I believe that if you shout long enough and loud enough, people will listen. I'm going to shout long, and I'm going to shout loud.
It does make the point that you can have a great speech that might not have great surroundings and will make an impression on individuals.
I have only one message now, and that is for Mrs. Thatcher and her government. Men, women and families are together now, and you've got one hell of a bloody fight on your hands.
There are several rhetorical devices from which great speeches are constructed. Simon Lancaster.
So you have the rule of three. A famous example of this is Friends, Romans, Countrymen, and this creates an illusion of completeness and finality. So if you want an argument to appear cut and dried, then you use the rule of three. It makes arguments sound complete, final, beyond a doubt.
The American president, John F. Kennedy, delivering his powerful inaugural address in 1961.
Not a new balance of power, but a new world of law, where the strong are just and the weak secure and the peace preserved.
Another great technique is imagery and the power of metaphor in particular. Metaphor works on two levels. On a basic level, it illuminates an abstract issue. But crucially, the second level it works at is its persuasive ability, that it can put an audience into a particular frame of mind without them even realising what's going on. If you think about the history of the world since the Second World War, you can tell it through metaphor. So the Iron Curtain to the Cold War, to the wind of change, to the swing in 60s, to the winter of discontent, to the Iron Lady, to the axis of evil and the smoking gun.
The wind of change was a phrase coined by the British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan in a speech given to the South African Parliament in 1960, which signalled the end of Britain's imperial ambitions in Africa.
And the most striking of all the impressions that I have formed since I left London a month ago is of the strength of this African national consciousness. The wind of change is blowing through this continent. Whether we like it or not, this growth of national consciousness is a political fact.
By using the metaphor of African nationalism as wind and using a metaphor of nature, he was reinforcing the view, or trying to create the view, that we couldn't stop it, because we all understand that forces of nature are unstoppable. And so by saying the wind of change, he was saying it's just going to happen. That was the argument he was making to the British people. There's nothing we can do about this. We must just let African nationalism happen. We must dismantle the empire.
And this tide of national consciousness, which is now rising in Africa, is a fact for which you and we are ultimately responsible.
It's very interesting that de Gaulle in France, who was also faced with the challenge of African nationalism, used a very different metaphor, and that's because he believed that African nationalism could be stopped. And he used the metaphor of the insurgents as vermin. And so what do we do with vermin? We exterminate vermin. Another really powerful rhetorical device is the technique of contrast. And to be or not to be is probably the greatest example of contrast from Shakespeare, who was himself a master rhetorician.
Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate.
Contrast was a technique which President John F. Kennedy used to great effect.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
Contrast works because it heightens our senses. It makes us feel more alert, and we're more used to thinking of things in twos. So when things are presented in twos, it makes our ears prick up and we're more likely to listen.
Connecting with an audience is one of the most critical aspects of great speech making.
There are a number of ways that an orator can establish a rapport with an audience, or win their approval, if you like. And one of the first and easiest ways is flattery, that no one ever objects to being told that they're brilliant.
I know you didn't do this for me. You did this because you believed in the most American of ideas, that in the face of impossible odds, people who love this country can change it.
Also, empathy is just very important, showing that you feel what the audience feels or you understand what the audience understands. And also, it's very important just having some common ground with the audience. I think Barack Obama is the king. And his trick was not necessarily that he was agreeing with everyone. It was creating the impression that he was agreeing with everyone. He did that by creating such deliberately blank phrases that anyone could interpret into them whatever they wanted to.
And those who tell us that we can't, we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of a people. Yes, we can.
Yes, we can. What does that mean? Everyone's going to hear that phrase and think something very, very different. Of course, it's a feeling, it's a positive statement, but to some people that will mean yes, we can get the house we want. To others it will mean yes, we can get the job we want. To others it might just feel good. The point is that everyone will read it a different way. Another great Obama line: they said this day would never come. What day? Who said?
They said this day would never come. They said our sights were set too high.
And so ambiguity is often a very powerful device as well, because people will listen to things and reach their own interpretations. They'll kind of take a sentence and then fit it in with all of their values, beliefs and opinions and twist it and hear what they want to hear. One example of this is Tony Blair's "Tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime." What a great sentence. If you're a hang 'em, castrate 'em kind of guy, then you'll just hear the first three words of that and think, fantastic, he agrees with me. If you're a more liberal sympathy for the downtrodden, then you're going to hear the "tough on the causes of crime," the kind of, oh, it's not really their fault. And so people will read different things into a sentence like that, and yet that shows empathy.
Making an emotional connection with an audience is one of the most important elements of a successful speech.
For all the status, the glamour, the applause, Diana remained throughout a very insecure person at heart.
Earl Spencer, though not known for his skills as an orator, is remembered for his eulogy in 1997 at the funeral of Diana, Princess of Wales, when he expressed concern for her children.
On behalf of your mother and sisters, I pledge that we, your blood family, will do all we can to continue the imaginative and loving way in which you were steering these two exceptional young men.
He decided to play up rather than playing down the emotion in a way that caused tremendous waves right around the world. And it felt so out of time and so fairy tale, and just at the point where Diana was becoming the fairy tale, I think it really kind of hammed up the emotion at a time where the royal family had been a bit standoffish and people wanted to have their emotions bigged up rather than played down. And so I think he played to the audience very well, and a lot of people remember it.
It is a point to remember that of all the ironies about Diana, perhaps the greatest was this. A girl given the name of the ancient goddess of hunting was, in the end, the most hunted person of the modern age.
And he talked about the origins of her name, Diana, as the ancient god of hunting, thereby suggesting that she had been hunted by the paparazzi and perhaps hadn't enjoyed the protection that she might have been entitled to. So his task in that speech, as far as he was concerned, was both to raise his own standing by getting on the right side of public emotion that he did, but also to kind of instill in memory the version of Diana that he wanted remembered as this vulnerable person who didn't have the support that she could have expected. On both counts, he succeeded.
Winston Churchill is perhaps the most famous orator of the modern era. He proved the power of rhetoric to rally a nation at a time of war, delivering this rousing speech to the House of Commons in June 1940, at a critical point in the Second World War.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
You repeat a phrase or word or clause within a particular sentence and do so in order to show that you are fixated about an issue, that you feel very emotional about it. Of course, he could have said, we will fight on the streets, comma, sands, comma, beaches, comma, but that would have lost the effect. And by emphasising, we will fight, we will fight, we will fight, that is actually all the audience will then hear.